You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
Era, and I noticed that you had my music playing it, John. It's Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch. I was so enamored by it. I was like, that's a good song, and I was so honored that you included it in our podcast.
Yeah, just thank you for not putting a copyright claim on it.
Oh, of course. I'm not that kind of guy. As long as you're not a plant. Are you a plant, John?
No.
You're not?
No.
Okay,
because
we're just here to relax. It's going to be fine. You don't use your M. Night Shyamalan magic on me. We'll be A-okay. Hey, everybody. It's Christopher Herman. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank Mark Wahlberg for joining us for this podcast. Oh, it's no problem, Chris. But, you know, it's great. John, we're back. It's episode 6.
Mm-hmm.
I thought episode 5 was pretty good.
Yeah, it was pretty all right.
I had a lot of fun with that.
Kindergarten was a great year.
Oh, man, it was. Now we're 6 years old, and now we're in first grade,
yeah.
I guess. We haven't been held
this
back.
This is when stuff gets real.
Mm-hmm. Then it gets serious. Fucking, they start doing multiplication in class, and I don't need any of that junk. But yes, everyone, welcome to We Are Error. I am Christopher Herman, and I'm with my co-host John Romo. And there you go. And this is OneOfUs.net's premier video game podcast. It's only video game podcast, but it is definitely its premiere. And so first of all, let's just kind of get into news today. I mean, okay, so a lot of big stuff happened, you know, recently. Probably the biggest thing was the PS4 Pro was announced at a Sony's PlayStation event. And, of course, it was unveiled as Sony's 4K HDR-supporting console. It has a price tag of $400, and there's some other monies right there. I don't recognize all those symbols. It's fake Monopoly money, as we said. You know, if you're not dollars, then you're not real.
If you're not dollars, you're not making any sense.
That's very good.
Thank you.
John's so smart, guys. The system, lead systems architect Mark Cerny shared some of the updated specifications for the PS4 Pro, including that the console will be double the power of the GPU and has a boosted clock rate of the CPU. I'm not going to go into all the specific nonsense of that because it's all junk and I don't understand it.
It's all bloody blah.
It's all blah. It's, like,
it's bigger. Okay. It's badder. Mm-hmm. And it's what you need. It's not what I want.
No. And that's the thing is, and they kind of went into some other things. I thought, this is nice that it'll apparently be very easy to transfer your data, your save data from your PS4 to the PS4 Pro. But there are like a few concerns that I particularly had. Like, okay, so the console is hyped because of the fact that it's in 4K. It's like, buy it for your 4K television where it's in 1660p and all this other kind of nonsense. But the thing that I find so funny, even though it's like their 4K console, apparently it doesn't have a 4K Blu-ray player.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, then why would I buy this?
Yeah.
Like, why?
I don't even have a 4K television because I can't afford one.
That's the thing is, like, I saw this and was like, oh, I don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I was just like, well, I'll just get the PS4 Slim because I do still want a PS4.
Yeah.
And I think the Slim's a nice little console.
Exactly. And plus, it has, like, what, 2 terabytes with it? Or it never has the.
No, I believe the Pro comes with 1 terabyte, so the Slim should probably come around half of that.
Oh, see? Well.
Which I don't really trip about because I don't need 8 games downloaded at once on the console.
Oh, I do.
I have hard enough time playing one at a time. So,
to constantly delete stuff from my Xbox One and my PS4.
But, like you said, you pointed out,
yeah.
One, as, you know, fresh out of college, I don't really see the use in a 4K TV right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a 4K monitor. I might get that at some point. High dynamic range. Really cool, really beautiful, but I don't really see the need in that. And I think I've talked about this before on the show.
Yeah.
If I'm going to get invested in VR, I don't really see the PlayStation VR being the one I would pick.
See, for me, it is the one. Well, in regards to VR, it would be the one I would pick because Oculus is going to be ridiculously expensive when they finally push that out to, you know, mass mm-hmm. audience. Like, at least the VR, which it'll probably be, what, $400 or $500?
Mm-hmm.
At least, again, the VR would work for the PlayStation 4, or what have you. But then, like, Oculus, I have to use a PC, and my PC definitely can't hit. It just be, it's too confusing, you know.
I understand that, but from the way I see it, the way I see VR continuing to grow,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very hard for it to grow with a console.
Oh, sure.
Because I see it, if they want to improve the VR, then you're going to need a new PlayStation, and then PS5 yeah. wouldn't be compatible with PlayStation VR. Mm-hmm. You're going to need PlayStation VR 2.
Yeah.
And so, to me, I see, if I'm getting invested in VR, all the experiments are more likely to be on PC.
Yeah.
And at that point, if I'm committing to PC, I would just, like, go all in. Like, yeah. VR is going to be expensive regardless.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Might as well just commit to PC. Like, mm-hmm. The way I said it before is, my perfect setup really is a fat, awesome Windows PC that can run everything.
Yeah.
And it takes, PlayStation console and then Nintendo handheld.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want.
You're done with Xbox, apparently, John?
Because that's what the PC is.
Microsoft.
I see Microsoft just, like, using Xbox as a brand, mm-hmm. but basically becoming a PC.
Okay.
All of their stuff will be on PC.
I get that. But for me, like, for the PS4 Pro, like, I just don't understand the point of it. Again, like we said, I don't have a 4K television. I mean, if I were to, you know, once I'm making more money, I would want to buy one, and, you know, a 4K television. But then the fact that the Blu-ray player is not even playing 4K Blu-ray, it's like, I just don't see the point. And for me, it just feels like it's a stopgap in between the PS4 and eventually what the PS5 is going to be. I just don't see the purpose of this. Whereas, like, with the Scorpio, from what we've been told, like, that does have a 4K Blu-ray player.
Yep.
It seems to be making up for the mistakes that the Xbox One made.
I believe even
the
One S has a
4K. Yeah, the One S, which is, I think, coming out later this
One S is out.
Oh,
the
this?
Slim.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Slim,
oh, oh no, slim. You're right. Yeah, yes. I get them all confused. But yes, you're right. Yeah, the Slim Xbox, or the Xbox One S, that does come with a 4K Blu-ray player, as well as, I think, like, the Scorpio and everything like that. So, yeah, I think kind of Sony just kind of, I think, bumbled this launch. And I actually watched the conference, and it reminded me of, like, the old days of Sony, like, when they announced the PS3, and, like, you know, I was getting flashbacks of Giant Enemy Crab. I'm thinking, ooh, this is just really awkward. And even, like, the gameplay reveals, and we'll kind of get into that right now, I found pretty disappointing. And, I mean, one of the most disappointing ones was probably the one for Spider-Man PS4, which I was like, oh, we're going to see new Spider-Man gameplay footage, and it's literally, like, 10 seconds, and they talk about how, look at you can see the fibers in Spider-Man's costume. It's like, okay. And then it just cuts to something else. It's like, what? That's all you're going to show for
the
new Spider-Man
game? Like,
so obnoxious.
It
carries over the other
games.
I
hate getting into talking about graphics, really, at some point, because it's nice and pretty to look at, mm-hmm. but for, I think, the average consumer, they're okay with 1080p versus mm-hmm. 4K. Like, it's a huge difference from someone who really cares about it, and I do sometimes. But it's games, so I care about the games part.
Yeah.
What I think is the coolest part about the PlayStation 4 Pro is the fact that you get an upgraded Netflix and YouTube app to try and push the 4K content. I see that as them just trying to ease it in. But back to what you said about it being reminding you of the PlayStation 3, you know, press conference. It's, again, I think I've talked about this before, where a company gets complacent.
Yeah, they get, yep.
Microsoft is making pushes because they fucked up the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a cycle sort of situation. While Nintendo's in the background just twiddling their thumbs like they did.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Nintendo's there.
Nintendo just going, oh, we'll put Mario on the iPhone.
Yeah.
Whatever. We'll just put it on the iPhone. Yeah. That's what
Nintendo
we're
will
do
what they want, and it'll service whatever audience it's trying to seek. But, yeah, and then there's, you know, recently Sony also announced some peripherals for the PS4. You're going to get a new DualShock controller, and, like, the biggest thing about it is that the light bar won't be that giant fucking thing in the back, but a nice little tiny one, like, right in the front, which I'm perfectly fine with, because that's one of the biggest problems with the DualShock, at least for me. It's like that light bar, it just illuminates everything in front of me, and I can even see it in my television, that light. So
I still don't get why that's there. Then the next peripheral that we mentioned is probably why it was there.
Yeah, yeah. Then, of course, we have a redesigned PlayStation camera. It has the same internal features as the original PS4 version, but it now comes with a cylinder shape with an angle adjusting stand.
Yeah.
Presumably to allow easier use for the PlayStation VR.
If you're using the original PlayStation camera and care about this camera, please let me know.
Yeah, because we certainly don't care. But then also we get a new stand.
Yes, vertical play!
Woo! And also a new platinum wireless headset with 7.1 virtual surround sound, 3D audio for games that support it, and noise-canceling hidden microphone, a lot, yada, yada, yada.
This is the best thing, because if you do get that new iPhone, You're going to need this.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, it's just, okay. I mean, again, this is just extra stuff that if you want to purchase it. And again, if you're not going to purchase a PS4 Pro, then this is pretty irrelevant, in all honesty. But despite kind of the disappointing console reveal and some of the peripherals, there were a couple of game reveals as well, specifically for Mass Effect Andromeda, which... You know, for a while, I'm like, when are they going to fucking show this game? And originally, EA came out after E3, after they were criticized heavily for their E3 presentation. EA said, oh, you'll learn more about Mass Effect in the fall, right? That's when we'll next debut it. And technically, it's not the fall yet. You know, we're still in the middle of summer, even though it's September. I have to say, the gameplay reveal for Mass Effect Andromeda, which kind of takes place in this, I don't know what it is, but it's like this... kind of like Tron inspired like ancient like labyrinth like tomb type place, mm-hmm. and where you have the player character, and it looks very similar, like the layout, how the player character moves around and just like the presentation of him, it felt to me like Dragon Age Inquisition, which I don't know if you played, John.
I've not played.
It's very good game. It kind of corrects the mistakes that were made with 2, and to a certain degree even 1. It's a great RPG, but just the way the character moves around and how he's presented in the middle of the screen is very, very reminiscent of a Dragon Age Inquisition, and even how he kind of interacts with the environment, and there's a lot of things that you can look at and things like that. But to me, we really learned nothing from the little bit of gameplay that we saw. Apparently, you're encountering this new alien species called the Remnant, and like I guess you're also with one of your squad mates, presumably an Asari. I think, yeah, it's an Asari who. Even though I guess she's either an archaeologist or a researcher, but she's still wearing a belly shirt. And she's sorry, do I guess? And then they're pursued by these organic machine-like creatures when they activate. They touch a button, they pull a Prometheus, and they touch something they probably
never
shouldn't.
Touch alien things.
No, they don't. Yeah,
it doesn't work out for you.
It certainly does not. But then also, what was revealed as well was that the player-controlled character, Ryder. In the past Mass Effect games, you can select either a male or female shepherd. Well, apparently in this, the male and female characters that you can either select are actually siblings. They're brother and sister. So if you happen to select a male character, you'll still be able, I assume you'll be able to interact with your sister, whether on your adventures or, you know, vice versa. I think that's really cool. But for me, as a lifelong Mass Effect fan who's obsessed with this series and all the characters and the lore, I just thought this first gameplay reveal was really underwhelming. I don't know how you felt about it.
Well, as someone who played about an hour of the first Mass Effect, I feel a little bit on the opposite. I would love to really get into it. I love the fact that it's a brother and sister combination.
Yeah, because that's really unique.
It raised a lot of questions for me. I just thought, well, how different will their respective stories be?
Yeah.
Will there be like intertwining things? And I believe their siblings... their father is a character you would have met.
Yes, thank you for bringing it up. Yeah, in the first kind of trailer for the game, which is the N, you see the person who's dressed up as the N7, which is the same military program that Commander Shepard was a part of. That person in that first trailer is actually their father. And Ryder, I guess that's the family name.
Yeah, right.
So I think that's pretty cool, and maybe this is a family story. And it kind of fits in with how BioWare's been talking about Andromeda, saying that it's... Even though it's a very expansive story, it's going to be a story about family,
which
I think is really cool.
I think that's why I'm really interested in it, because sometimes I get overwhelmed with the fact that one playthrough barely scratches the surface.
Yeah.
That there, you could do 8 playthroughs and there's still so much. It's kind of exhausting to me. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, I see as it being maybe 2 playthroughs is all you need. And, you know, even then, it's just minor little differences.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be missing out on much if you only play one. But I love this sort of self-contained stories within a larger universe, akin to what I see the Star Wars franchise also doing, which I think I've said before on our other shows, that's what interests me most about the Star Wars franchise, is the opportunity to be in a universe that you know and, you know, care about, but explore very succinct and defined narratives.
Yeah.
And I just find that much more enjoyable and a lot easier to hop into.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and it just gives you more reason to play as either the female or the male character in this. And I have both a femme shep, as she's called, and a male shepherd character. I'll do it again with these the characters, and I'll have different versions of them. So, I mean, despite the kind of underwhelming gameplay, I like the ideas that BioWare is presenting.
Yeah, and so. I really, this makes me want to see 1 and 3 remastered people to have the opportunity to experience those on, you know, these next-gen consoles.
Absolutely, but yeah, continuing on with kind of more Sony news. So, you know, the little Pokemon Go game that came out a while ago proved to be very popular, even though apparently now it's crash and burn. Like, no one is talking about it. No one seems to care anymore, except for the really, really hardcore. But Sony is going to follow suit and apparently say, oh, those that mobile game market, that sounds pretty interesting. So Sony chief executive Kaz Harari has said that Sony will be aggressively entering the mobile gaming market following the success of Pokemon Go. Mobile game, this is according to him, mobile gaming is something we are aggressively getting into, Harari told the Financial Times. It's quite a shift from being just a console-based business on being to being on mobile phones as well. Harari makes it pretty clear why that's the case. Pokemon Go is a real game changer, he explained. I'm very interested in the fact that it has the potential to really change the way people move, literally. It is an innovative idea that's going to lift all boats for the video game industry. Now Sony has kind of in the past talked about like their push into mobile games, specifically with I think the developer called Forward Works. Now they haven't revealed anything that they're working on right now, but as someone who is kind of detests mobile gaming and for just this kind of lack of content. I mean, I don't particularly like this news because I feel like even though it's like it's a separate thing and hopefully it won't influence anything that's on the console, it's like I just wish those resources went to a studio, you know, who can make a great console game.
I don't know if we hadn't discussed this off mic, but did you pay attention to the iPhone announcement stuff?
I'm an Android user. I don't give a fuck about Apple.
The note I wrote on this was, so iPhone wins? Because the thing I alluded to about Mario earlier is Shigeru Miyamoto was at the Apple event.
Right.
He presented a new Mario game.
Mm-hmm.
So Mario is officially on the iPhone.
Yes.
And
yes.
This is Sony sort of saying, like, oh, this is where we need to be is... Mm-hmm. You know, I'm saying iPhone because they have the bigger app store. They have the, you know, mainstream.
It's more popular brand.
Yeah, they have the mainstream crossover appeal. Yeah. And I think we've talked about this before, too. These two, they're Japanese companies.
And they fucking hate each other.
And so, but like, the Japanese culture is much more mobile friendly. Everyone's moving and interacting with each other.
Yeah.
So I see this as, of course, this is finally what they're going to do. Mm. On one hand, it does suck, I think, that more money should go towards these other developers. But on the other hand, with Nintendo also putting a little focus there, maybe we could actually see some brand new things. I believe Kaz mentioned AR is something he wants to get into.
Yes. Yeah,
as long as Nintendo and Sony are both pushing and competing on these mobile platforms with their IPs that we like, these iPhones are getting very powerful. They're really unique computers. This is a new battlefront, and I see both companies being on the same thing, competing, could be a good thing for just industry and handheld mobile gaming as a whole. So.
Yeah, I can't wait to see all the different versions of Mario Runner and Uncharted
Then
Runner
again, yes, it could just be a bunch of runners, and this sucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I'm concerned about, that they're going to milk their brands and then make those brands kind of less special.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just me. Even if they do put out something that's supposedly great on a mobile device, I'm still not going to play it because that's not where I go for my games, typically. Even though I know a lot of people do.
I don't know. Downwell on iOS is pretty damn good.
Is it?
Downwell, yeah.
What is it? What's Downwell?
It's just a little indie game that you fall down a cave or a well.
Okay.
You fall down a well and you kind of shoot. It's also progressively, not progressively, randomly generated, a la Splunky, Rogue Knight, something like that.
Okay.
But it's very fun.
All right. Oh, maybe they put it on a console, I'll play it. so, continuing on with, I guess, some disappointing news. So you remember last E3, or last Nintendo, not the most recent Nintendo Direct, but the Nintendo Direct during E3. Nintendo, or this was last year, wasn't it? Yeah, whatever. Nintendo debuted a new Metroid game.
Yay!
Yay! Except it was It was Metroid Prime Federation Force,
boo.
Which not really the Samus, not really the Triumphant Return of Samus Aran. It's, I think it was like a sequel to a, like a really old DS game, like one of the first like launch titles for the DS. Yeah, Hunters, that was it. But yeah, so I mean, the reaction to the footage at E3 for Federation Force was not very good. It was pretty disappointing, in all honesty, and did not look good at all. Well. According to Famitsu's latest sales data, which is in Japan, and then translated by Kotaku, the 3DS game apparently in Japan has only sold 4,286 copies. Wow.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I told you so. You know, people recognize when something looks like garbage. And I think this isn't the case where everyone's like, no. And this is just, it hasn't been released in the United States yet. I mean, I'd point that out. It'll probably sell... maybe a few thousand copies here, I imagine. But for this, it's just staggering how poorly the game has sold. And as someone who is, you know, really hasn't gotten, in my opinion, really has seen a Metroid game worth playing in almost a decade, it's just disappointing. We're, again, it's kind of the watering down of the brand of something that looks, that's totally not what we wanted from Metroid. And it just kind of shows Nintendo's deafness to all this. And John, I mean, were you at all excited for Metroid Prime Federation Force?
My favorite thing about your reaction to this mm-hmm. is you didn't know it came out in America.
Right? Oh, did it already come
it
out?
It came
in the
out
States?
A week before.
Oh shit! Well,
Japan.
Put an asterisk right next to my prior.
No, I was just laughing yeah. when you said it. I was like, this actually just puts this point even forward.
Yeah. It's like, who fucking cares about this thing?
This is not really surprising. Yeah. Metroid has always been one of the weaker selling.
No, true.
Nintendo's.
Historically,
it's a yeah. very Western kind yeah. of selling franchise, which is why it doesn't get much attention yeah. ever, because Nintendo doesn't care about the Western market as much.
No, you're absolutely right. I think like there's what been collectively 11 or 12 Metroid games, and I think across all those games, they've just sold, I think, just over 30 million copies.
Yeah,
which is like staggering. When you think about that.
Like, I think in America, we always picture it's like Mario, Link, Samus, Fox. Like, those are Nintendo's characters.
Yeah.
It's not really,
really
like
really
that in Japan.
Really
it's
Mario,
really just Mario and Link.
And Link, yeah. Yeah. yeah.
And you know, Pikachu, to an extent.
Oh, Pikachu, yeah. The Pokemon, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really find this as surprising, mm-hmm. but I really hate what this also means. It selling so poorly
yeah.
is sort of just in confirms what Nintendo is trying to already think.
And or trying to get us to think.
Yeah, yeah, and it's setting up the franchise for failure,
yeah.
which this year was its anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know,
and they did nothing with it.
They did
yeah.
nothing except for copyright ban fan-made game for Metroid
yes,
2. One that is not
episode.
Easily available for people to get to
no.
because it was the one that was right on the Game Boy. Which was also an interesting time for them to put direct sequels on the Game Boy.
Yeah,
to an NES game.
Nintendo being Nintendo.
Yeah, and I think that's basically what this is.
Yeah.
Is Nintendo being Nintendo, not respecting a franchise that they own
mm-hmm.
Very well.
Yeah.
But
I mean, mishandling it and just kind of continuing to spell the death of the franchise.
Yeah,
I mean,
which
really
is very
disappointing.
Disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And maybe they did this on purpose to kill any sense of excitement. Although they said, you know, I mean, Reggie said, oh, we got a, you know. We know that you want a true Metroid game.
Reggie is a puppet.
Yeah, Reggie. He literally is a puppet. As we saw in that one Nintendo Direct, he was a puppet. Very, very odd. Yeah, but despite that disappointing bit of Nintendo news, I want to end on something happy. So Pokemon's Sun and Moon is coming out, I think, this fall. And, you know, again, as someone who has kind of been disenfranchised with the Pokemon franchise, I'm still looking forward to this. This looks like maybe a return to those glory days of Red, Blue, and Gold and Silver. But there was a new feature announced. And specifically, in the game, using your Pokedex, you'll be able to take pictures. Now, for all you youngins out there, there was this little Nintendo N64 game called Pokemon Snap. Where all you did in the game was take pictures of Pokemon. It was like an on-rails type of thing. And you just took the pictures of Pokemon. You throw apples at them. You threw these paralyzed balls at them. And you basically murdered them. It was great. Fun time. I loved it. You were like a wartime photographer. But, and like for years, I'm thinking, you know what? I would totally want to play another Pokemon Snap game. And so finally, Nintendo is finally listening and including at least a version of Pokemon Snap with Sun and Moon. So, John, are you at all excited for this? And did you play the original Pokemon Sun and Moon?
You mean Pokemon Snap?
Yeah, Snap.
Oh, no. Yeah, I played it a little bit, mm-hmm. but again, that was N64, PlayStation were sort of when I was introduced to games, as
sure,
we'll get into
sure,
later
sure, sure.
on mm-hmm, in this mm-hmm. episode. But so I got a little hands-on time with it, but never really got into it because I was still so little.
Yeah. You're a little guy.
Yeah, I was like four.
Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ.
The notes I wrote on this, though, were, sell me on this, Chris, because I just don't care.
Oh, John, it's beautiful. You get, okay, so the original Pokemon Snap, you played the, not the, the Brock and Misty replacement in, like, the second or third season of Pokemon. I forget what his guy, the hell the guy's name was. But he was in a blue shirt, and he was kind of annoying and stuff, but he was obsessed with taking pictures of Pokemon. He was all into it. He was posting them online, you know, putting sexy Pikachus out there and everything like that. But since that character was so unpopular, but the concept was like, yeah, this is gonna be something. And, yeah, it was put out in the N64, and I just loved it because, really, it was like an on-rails thing, and I think there were, like, only five locations that you can go throughout the game. Like, there was a fire level, a swamp level, water, and, like, a generic, like, kind of green forest area. And, yeah, what you would do is you go through all these different areas and take pictures of Pokemon. You, like, rack up points, and, like, you can... I remember, like, at Blockbuster, you can actually, I think, take your memory card... and, like, plug in the your N64 memory card, like, and they had this, like, this whole machine where then you could, like, download your pictures of the Pokemon you actually took and, like, you know, just go home and look at all your pictures. I thought that was such a cool idea. And, I mean, again, it was a number of years ago, the fact that I mentioned Blockbuster. That shows how old I am. But I just have kind of warm, nostalgic memories of that. And, yeah, it probably wasn't a very good game to begin with, and it was totally a gimmick. And it was, I mean, that was the early days of Nintendo going after the gimmicks. But for me, as someone who will buy...
Stopped.
Huh?
And they never quite stopped.
No, they didn't. It got worse. But as someone who is going to buy Pokemon Sun and yeah, Pokemon Sun and Moon, I'm glad this feature's in here. Because, you know, again, kind of... Nintendo just milking that nostalgia, and I'll take my sexy pictures of Pikachu and Snorlax and all that good stuff, put them together.
I think it's just, I'm not a big fan of looking at Pokemon trailers all the time.
About sexy Pokemon.
Because they do the same thing. It's always the same sort of thing. It's just like, here's a new Pokemon. Here's a new one. I did realize that some of the newer ones that they revealed get really weird looking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't even want to talk about them because I can't pronounce half of them.
I just can't wait. I love
a chubby Raticate.
I love when Nintendo just like gives, or the Pokemon company just like gives up and go, I don't know.
Yeah.
Put something weird on it.
Put keychain. Lamp. Lampmon. It's like, what is going on? This
what
is inanimate objects.
What haven't we made one out of?
Yeah.
I don't know. There was a Game Boy over there. Game Boy Pokemon.
Game Boy Mon. look, I'm all for it.
It's just, to me, it's like, who are you selling, mm-hmm. I guess? Mm-hmm. I feel like at this point you know mm-hmm. whether you're going to get the new Pokemon or not.
Yeah. No. No, you're absolutely right. Again, it's totally there for nostalgic purposes, and I'll definitely...
Which I think is cool. I do think that part's cool. Mm-hmm. And Chubby Ratatat, for what it's worth, is kind of cool.
He's cute.
That is my favorite thing about this stuff, is that there is this sort of dark light feature where Pokemon get sort of mutated a bit. Mm-hmm. I think that's the coolest thing mm-hmm. about this whole new game.
Kind of like Pokemon Uranium.
Yeah.
Where
they
you
give them
mutated,
little mutations.
Irradiated Pokemon.
So, I can't wait to be really excited mm-hmm. to buy this game, to play an hour of it, and then never play it again.
Because
that's what's happened these last few Pokemon.
I did that with X and Y, and that was because I'm like, I don't know where anything is, and it wasn't familiar to me. And the 3D aspect of that game kind of threw me off, which I was just so used to kind of the
3D as in, like, on the 3DS part, or 3D as in 3D animation?
Oh, the 3D animation. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I was so used to the sprites and just everything about it. It just felt very cluttered. And maybe,
so busy.
So busy, yeah, that's it. And maybe with this, I'm willing to give it another try. And the fact that the starters actually look pretty cool. I love that little fucking owl with the little boat, green bow tie. I'm like, I want that owl so bad.
I just love the fact that 3D animation just was too busy for you old man.
Yeah, I'm
let's go back to the sprites.
Okay, watch and learn.
Oh, I'm learning.
Is this it?
No, it has to load.
Load?
Yes.
This is taking a really long time.
You have no patience.
When you turn something on, you expect it to... Okay, here we go. Crash Bandicoot.
You know, I always wondered if Nathan Drake ever, like, just stayed up late at night thinking about all the people he's murdered over his adventures. He's probably killed at least like 5,000 people across all four games, not including the mobile titles either or the handhelds.
Well, when you're that good looking, you're trying to get away with murder.
Yeah, he doesn't care. I mean, he is so he's joking. Like, it's different with like Indiana Jones, where he's killing fucking Nazis and cultists and Russians. It's like, yeah, who fucking cares about those people?
Yeah, see, he's like killing bad people, so it's fine. Yeah. It is fine. He's American.
Yeah, true. He is American with Nathan Drake. He's just killing foreigners, so who cares, right? He's like, oh, whatever. But yes, guys, welcome to the next part of We Are Air, where we're talking about the history of Naughty Dog, probably one of the best developers, if not the best developer, working today.
Oh yeah, I think I'll dig into that deeper as we like go along this whole thing. But do you know why we were talking about Naughty Dog this week, Chris?
I don't know, Joe.
Because it is the 20th anniversary tomorrow, as of this recording. So we're recording on the 8th. Mm. 20 years ago, on the 9th, Crash Bandicoot debuted on the PlayStation.
I was like, where are you going with this? Oh, man. Here's the thing, guys. Here's the thing, listeners. Crash Bandicoot, he fucking sucks.
Okay, see,
those three games, they were bestsellers on the PlayStation. I think all 1, 2, and 3, I think were all in like the top 10 best-selling PS1 games. Those games have not aged
Crash
well.
Bandicoot 3 Warped was the first PlayStation title to sell a million from the West.
Jesus.
To sell a million in Japan.
Yeah.
Big moment for PlayStation and Naughty Dog. So, listeners, the only reason this is a Naughty Dog retrospective and not us deep diving into Crash alone is because Chris thinks those games are bad. They are, and they might be bad, but they're like I said earlier in this episode, PlayStation is where I started. Mm-hmm. So this franchise and then this company, I think, has just followed me as I've grown along. Sure. They are, honestly, I think my favorite company.
Yeah.
We can really get into it, like slowly get into it, but they are my favorite developer of across the three, or and I guess if you want to count Last of Us, four biggest franchises that they have made. I think they're some of the best franchises.
Sure. Certainly the last two I would agree on. But okay, so John, sell me on Crash Bandicoot. Why is he cool?
It's hard to explain.
Yeah, exactly.
This does come from pure nostalgia. But you know, basically they are just sort of like tunnel runners.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But it's so much fun music going on. He's such a wacky, fun character. I think
Bugs Bunny.
He's the mime version of Sonic, so it's kind of a response.
Oh, God. That's perfect, yes.
He's a response similarly to what Nintendo was doing. You can go back and watch some of those old commercials where Sony was kind of poking fun at Nintendo.
Oh, sure.
And this was just a hot, heated moment. You'll never see it again, I think, where three different companies are really competing at top of their game. Sega with the Saturn, which is when they would fall off. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it at the time, but you know they're coming hot off Genesis. Nintendo, you know, Super Mario 64 was just a couple weeks away, I believe.
Yeah.
And then Sony coming in,
entering the
console market with, you know, 9999 or 96. Sorry.
Yep.
With the PlayStation, it was just a huge moment, and I don't know, just like I said, I was born in 93, so I was still really little, and I would really love to return to these games.
Sure.
But Crash 2 was really where I kicked off, and then Crash 3, getting to explore, Warped is what it was called, has the most 90s-ass cover art where it's like Crash wearing shades and a motorcycle, motorcycle. There's a dinosaur and tiger in the background.
Of course.
He's got his sister or his girlfriend, I can't remember which, on the cover art.
Oh, that's good.
It was so 90s. And like, it's just goofy, has weird characters. I think it just has a lot of character without really saying too much. Like I said, Crash is a mime. There's just a lot of spirit to it. And then there's that Aku Aku, the mask, the booga booga, that thing. I don't know. A lot of it
is just a ripoff of Banjo Kazooie's Tiki guy. I don't remember his name. But
see, even that, I think this is where it's so obvious that I am a Sony person.
Yeah.
Because
even though you don't own a PS4, you own an Xbox One.
it all comes down to, like, my little brother bought the Xbox One, and I was like,
all right.
I was going to buy what he was going
to
buy.
I'm just busting your balls. Yeah. But, yeah, for me, you are right.
Why don't you like it? Tell me.
The thing is, it's just, I mean, it's a tunnel runner. You don't really do anything particularly special in the game, or the gameplay isn't, like, Super Mario 64 was going to come out, like, 3 weeks after, was it the original Crash Bandicoot? Mm-hmm. It's like, You can't compare those two. 64 is clearly superior. Banjo-Kazooie is clearly superior. Just in what you can do in all those games. I mean, I'll give Crash Bandicoot. It came at a time. Him and kind of the other PlayStation mascot at that time, Spyro, they were just there to be mascots.
Yeah.
You know, the funny cartoon characters. That's all they really were. Nothing that the picture really did in all those games was innovative or, in my opinion, fun. But I think as, like, just a... As a character, like, this is what we're using to sell our console to little kids. I get that. I do. But
and I was a little kid.
Yeah, so. And there you go. You were, like, 4 or 5 or whatever, buying all those expensive consoles with all your hard-earned cash.
I honestly don't even know why we had that. Yeah. It was probably 2000 when I actually played it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they were probably really old by then.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it was just like a little kid, like, ooh, look at this funny character making funny faces.
I will concede one thing. I thought the way in which Crash Bandicoot was used in a most recent game that came out this year... which you have not played yet, which I probably shouldn't spoil that.
No, no, no. I know the
you
clip.
You know what it is?
I know the clip.
That was brilliant.
And it's probably...
It's the only time Crash Bandicoot has ever been
clipped. And I know it's getting brought up, so it's going to be in this episode somewhere.
Yeah.
So
yes, yes.
Everyone definitely. Will get to experience
it. Say that for the latter two franchises that Naughty Dog has established. But
hold on. Before we leave, I also want to make a note, because it's just...
Keep
like,
going.
I was listening to the music, different podcasts, mm-hmm. VG Empire, shout out to Brett Elston. He does a cool little video game music podcast.
Yeah.
Be sure to check it out if you care about video game music. But they just released the Crash episode. So I was listening to the music again from Crash 2. And just like, I'm transported to being that little kid again. Just like mm-hmm. watching, like playing the game and just like controlling Crash. Because it was one of the first games where, like, it was me. I got to play it. I didn't have to watch my dad or my aunt. Like, okay. I mentioned with Resident Evil, I watched my aunt play it.
Mm-hmm.
Crash was one of those first where it's like, I know what to do. I can control it. And I don't ever actually ever think I beat them because I was still so little.
Mm-hmm.
And also, fun fact, I didn't have a memory card for the PlayStation. So every game I started from the beginning.
Again, and over
you
and over
don't
and
over. Know how many times I played, like, 5 straight hours of Tekken 3
mm-hmm.
so I could beat the game with every single character so I could get gone. But when we get to that Tekken franchise retrospective,
oh
we'll
yeah,
really
that'll,
get
that'll, Tekken 3 that'll is, happen.
Tekken 3 is one of the greatest fighting games of all time. You get to play a fighting dinosaur.
You can have that one when I'm not here. You can have your Tekken podcast. Ugh.
But where I started this on was I remember like sometimes I would just like not play. Like, I would just, like, sit the controller down, go do something, get a snack or whatever, because
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have a short attention span, and come back, and Crash is playing with a yo-yo. Or just, like, shuffling and throwing his head back and looking at the camera, making mm-hmm. a goofy face. I love rest animations, and I
rest
wish they would come
yeah.
back. Because mm-hmm. I was thinking, like, Mario would just fall asleep, and
yeah,
Sonic would,
horrible.
Like, tap his foot and just, like, are you gonna play? Yeah. I need to move.
I gotta get the fucking rings. I gotta get the fucking rings, man.
So just a quick shout out to Rest Animations.
Yeah, I get it. And the fact that Crash is one of the first games that you particularly played, that
yeah.
you were, you know, allowed to play and finish and then start over again and all that stuff. But I get that. To me, at that time, I was playing Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I was playing all those good PlayStation 1 games. Final Fantasy VI, still the best. But yeah, for me, yeah, to each their own. Moving on to another Naughty Dog series. Which I have played very little of.
Oh my gosh, I love this franchise so much, Chris.
So you're a fan of Jak and Daxter.
So much so. I don't know why. Oh, actually I do. Because Daxter, basically.
Oh, I fucking
hate
that.
I think the game...
So whatever the hell that thing is.
I think it's Naughty Dog, when they came off of Crash, their main character not having a voice. They were like, let's go the complete opposite.
Let's
not
make an annoying
let's
voice.
Let's make another orange character.
Yeah.
It's kind of even in spirit a little callback to, you know, Crash mm-hmm. in general, because it's an orange character. But this time, it's got a big old mouth.
Yeah.
And I think in the first game, Jak and Daxter, the precursor legacy, where Jak is in fact a mute,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the one I played the least amount. I did beat it, of course, because I love this franchise.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you get to play with this loudmouth character and this straight man and just really have fun exploring 3D platforming, because that's not exactly what Crash was. It was more of a 2D
running
sort of
game.
Yeah,
yeah,
2D running game. But this is Naughty Dog really expanding their chops and playing around with, you know, 3D spaces,
mm-hmm.
really expanding what they... Why I think I love this company so much in, you know, expanding upon characters. And, you know, it may not have worked for you. I was still
I didn't
little.
Play enough of it to feel either way about it. So,
And I, when did Jack and Daxter come out? Give me a second.
It came out, I think, in 2000 or 2001, I want to say. It was definitely the early 2000s. But yeah, I mean, for me, Jack and Daxter, I guess it was kind of like the one of the last few, like, just big 3D platformers, like at that time, because like, it had been dying. I mean, Banjo-Kazooie was kind of like the last hurrah for that, until we got Nuts and Bolts, which was very disappointing. But then even Spyro was dead at that point. You still had your occasional Mario game. And really, it was only Mario that was still consistently good at that time, and then fucking Sonic was just kept getting worse and worse. But I mean, when did Jack and Daxter come out? When was that?
The first one was in 2001.
Okay, I was right. I was fucking right. I remember
December 4th. So I was I was 8 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a perfect age for that kind of.
Yeah, game. Really starting to brains coming together. It's like, oh, I can play these games. Mm-hmm. I know what to do. Yeah. Couldn't quite beat it yet. I had to return to the first one after beating the second one. Mm-hmm. Which is when I really started to fall in love with it.
Yeah.
Is because now Jack can talk. And it's this weird thing where the second games in some franchises tend to get the most moody. And they really start. You saw this with Prince of Persia with Warrior Within, where for some reason he's cutting himself now.
He's an emo. he's an evil emo version of himself in one of the games.
Eventually he just splits. He gets a split personality. And the same thing happens in Jack 3, where he gets a light version. I've always had this great interest in light versus dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what really made me fall in love with the Jack franchise at this point, is he, like, gets this black goop that makes him become just like Dark Jack, and the gameplay changes up. Mm-hmm. At that point, Jack 2 was one of my first experiences with an open world, like, because GTA I could play,
because
Grand Theft Auto 3 I could play with the volume turned down. I wasn't allowed to play it yet with the the story, so I would just walk around. But Jack 2 I was allowed to play and really experience its world. It's very limited now. Mm-hmm. When looking back on it, but it had guns. It was a GTA 3 light, and it was very much a response to what GTA 3 did. We got plenty of copycats like that, but yeah, it just again expounded upon the characters. Jack, like I said, got to talk, and then it started to work in spoilers for Jack 2, work in time travel.
Yeah,
because you are transported to the future. It continues right after Jack 1, where you, like, get all the orbs and everything. Mm-hmm. You are transported to the future, and you kind of find out that you were from the future originally, and you're, like, a prince and stuff like this.
Oh.
And then things get really weird with Jack 3, where you're, like, thrown in the wasteland, and it gets even more badass.
Oh, it's like Mad Max.
Yeah.
Fight Lord Humongous in there?
Actually, it does have a Mad Max vibe, now that I realize it, because you also get the ability to, like, drive cars on the ground, which eventually gets spun off into Jack X, which is a kart racing game. And we
I had no idea that was a... There actually is a crash... Not to interrupt your flow there, but there was a kart racing Crash Bandicoot game, which I actually did like. Crash Team Racing.
Is why I always made the joke that I thought Uncharted 4 was never going to happen, that it was just going to be Uncharted carts. Uncarted.
Oh my god, that'd be awesome.
It writes itself. Uncarted.
Uncarted. Sony, you gotta hire John. Yeah. Give him his own studio.
And then there was The Lost Frontier, which actually was not developed by Naughty Dog, so I didn't play it because I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a Daxter spinoff for the PSP.
I don't give a fuck about Daxter.
Made by Ready at Dawn. A very competent, I think, wonderful at making spinoffs, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Aren't they the developers of, what is it called? The Order 1886?
I think that's one of their first big games.
Not a good game. So maybe they should keep making spinoffs.
But before we move on to the franchise where you can really talk.
Oh.
Before the mic has to get taken away from me.
Oh, no.
Another reason why I really loved this era in time was Sony was fighting against itself at this point.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time when I started to really understand and, like, know developers.
Yeah.
And these are the three developers that, to this day, I still, like, if I see that, it's like, I'm very interested in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Naughty Dog was competing against Insomniac in their Ratchet & Clank series, also Sucker Punch in their Sly series.
Yep, Sly's also good.
And I remember...
Those are better.
I remember talking to my best friend at the time.
Sly's great.
Like, still my best friend. Shout out to Taylor.
Yeah.
We would all play these games, and he was the Sly fan. Mm-hmm. I was obviously the Jack fan. Ratchet's fun. All of these games are fun, and... they still continue to evolve yep. and compete against each other. And I think it's just emblematic of why competition is great.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I love mascots. Like, fun.
Sure.
Like, furry, goofy mascots.
I'm a big furry fan. I know, John. We all know. You love it. You go to the conventions. You're all about that. You're dressing up as Crash Bandicoot. You're meeting with Birdo. And
dude, after I'm done recording, I'm going right to DeviantArt.
Are you doing? Yeah. Oh, man, DeviantArt.
I love DeviantArt.
I never even thought to go on DeviantArt and look up Crash Bandicoot or Jack and Dexter fan art.
I wouldn't even dare. Like, do not risk that at all, folks. But yeah, it was just a perfect. That's why I think the PlayStation 2,
mm-hmm.
best console. PlayStation 2 is one of the greatest consoles.
Oh, man, it'd be hard for... I think, just for me, if we're talking, like, best... I mean, I think like, the PS4 and Xbox One are the best consoles, because they're the most powerful, we're getting the most unique games. But in terms of... Just, like, as, like, a piece of hardware that I... Because, you know, eventually all of this stuff becomes... They start to port newer, older games onto these consoles. But if I have, like, any nostalgic feelings for particular Sony consoles, for the PS1, which, for me, had some of those experiences which I don't get anymore, like those JRPGs, like the Final Fantasy series when it was fucking good, or like the Castlevania series when it was fucking good. You know, again, I love those kind of games, and those are just not on... They weren't on the PS2 okay. or the PS3.
I'm sure there are people who will argue with you. I'm not a huge JRPG fan, because... Yeah.
I'm not anymore.
I ain't got the time.
Mm-hmm.
But Persona 3... Persona 4 technically was
on
the
PS2. Yeah, Persona 4 was PS2. You're right. I never got into that franchise.
Yeah. But there's PlayStation 2 has something for everybody. It also introduced me to my favorite franchise of all time, which is Kingdom Hearts. I have no idea why. Okay. It's like JRPG Lite.
Yeah.
I have no idea why I like that. When Kingdom Hearts 3 eventually comes out, we'll talk about it, and I'll really deep
We'll be dead when that comes out, John. We're never going to get... Yeah, when 2025 or whenever the hell that title's going to come out.
But yeah, I'll concede the floor a little bit. I'll stop gushing about these franchises.
I love hearing you talk about it. Yeah, it's great.
I don't know. It's when I really fell in love with video games on a different level than why I love them now.
Mm-hmm.
These are just fun to play. Sure. I love having the DualShock in my hand, the greatest controller.
I'll disagree with that.
And just having characters be characters, have these weird inflections and weird styles, but also very defined. It is what makes Naughty Dog Naughty Dog, and you can watch them progress from Crash to... They had games before that, but you can watch them progress from Crash to the Jak and Daxter franchise to where I think they really perfected and became AAA Naughty Dog, like the big dogs, no pun intended,
the big dog
in, you know, Sony's cabinet, their right hand guys when it comes to this is why you need a PlayStation.
No, I mean, so yeah, of course, like the next franchise we're going to go into is Uncharted, arguably probably the most popular. It's the flagship series on the PlayStation, just brand in general. Everyone knows about this series, and I think the first Uncharted came at a very important time for Sony, because the PS3 was struggling at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really have a particular game on it that was like, you need to buy this console. And he's like, even though we were told we need to get a second job to pay for it, famously, at that E3, I think, 2006 or 2005, it kind of blew everyone away, because it was an Indiana Jones adventure starring incredibly memorable and fun characters, and specifically introducing Nathan Drake, voiced by Nolan North, who would go on to voice every video game character ever for that franchise. But I think the reason why Uncharted 1 was such an eye-opening experience, particularly for people who hadn't gotten a PlayStation before, and was kind of the big reason why they first got that console, was that because it was just... It was like a third-person experience, but it had all the fun of an Indiana Jones movie. And it introduced such... incredible characters that felt so fleshed out, even though they were psychopathic killers to a certain extent with the enemies they killed. But like, just Nathan Drake as a character, and who he is, and how he's evolved throughout the course of the series. First meeting him here, and where he's this kind of not fucking pirate, but this rogue going on this grand adventure, and you have the father figure and Sully, and the love interest in Elena, and you have these ridiculous fucking villains. You know, you have your kind of generic, you know, British villain. You have the crazy character with Eddie Raja. I love it. And then you have the brown villain. Need a brown belt in those games. But even it's like, just so much about that game. It gave me an Indiana Jones experience where we hadn't really gotten an Indiana Jones adventure. I mean, what was your kind of a first experience of Uncharted, and what was that moment where you go, this is something special? Like, what about it that clicked with you?
I got into the PS3 late.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people.
Yeah, because, one, it was crazy expensive.
Yeah, $600.
I've always gotten to the new consoles maybe a year after.
Sure.
Especially at this point in time where I think I was in high school, mm-hmm. so I had the 360 first.
Yeah.
I think I got it around when Elder Scrolls came out. I think that was my first
game. Oh, so, okay, so the Elder Scrolls Oblivion?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was like 2007, I think? 2007, yeah. 2006? Which was the time that, Uncharted came out. So
I didn't get a PlayStation 3 until the consoles were maybe had a year or two left.
Right. Really? Okay.
I got the slimmest version that they released.
Okay, I know you're talking about.
So by the time I got to Uncharted 1, mm-hmm. I had already had 5 years of next-gen console gaming. So
right.
Uncharted 1 is good. Mm-hmm. It is a solid 7.5.
That's...
It is very much foundational. Mm-hmm. for what's about to come, mm-hmm. and so I can respect it in that sense. But it's still really fun to play, mm-hmm. but at that point in time, it didn't blow me away because sure. it was like 4 years old.
I think for me, the reason why I still think the way I do with Uncharted 1 is because I played it when it had come out, and I'd never played a type of game like that before, where it looked... I mean, I remember, this looked beautiful. It's in a great jungle environment where, you know, as compared to the later entries in the franchise, I'm sure it does not look nearly as well. The animations are not nearly as diverse or unique.
And that gunplay is not really fun.
The gameplay is...
The gunplay is just kind of wonky for my taste.
It's always been the weakest aspect of the Uncharted series, where the reason why I love that series so much is because it gave me that fun, Indiana Jones type adventure, and it introduced all these new characters. But you're right about the gameplay, or the gunplay specifically. It's always felt a little awkward, and it's at its most awkward in Uncharted 1, particularly during kind of the on rails segment, or God forbid, the god-awful jet ski portion of the game, which is so... where you have an infinite amount of grenades that Elena fires in the back of the jet ski. But yeah, that was probably the weakest portion of that game. But it, again, like you said, it established the foundation, established these characters who continued to evolve and who became surprisingly deep and interesting. And, I mean, do you have any kind of last-minute thoughts on Uncharted 1 or any, like, a particular character you thought stuck out, a particular segment of the game that you thought was really special at that time, maybe?
See, and this is where the problem comes in.
You can't remember?
I can't really recall any particular moments because I think about hanging from a freight train off the side of a cliff. Mm-hmm. I think about falling from an airplane into a desert. Mm-hmm. I think about getting chased by a car downstairs. I think about being followed by a helicopter. Mm-hmm. That all comes in the sequels.
It does.
But I do remember playing it and going, here we go again.
Yeah.
Naughty Dog creating a character that's about to take, like, control of this console for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can go ahead and move on to the one that really changed what I think, you know, people thought of games as movies actually was.
It was, I mean, Uncharted 2 Among Thieves, which for many people is the best Uncharted, in the four main games on the PlayStation.
I still
platforms.
Argue that very hard. I think 3 is about just as good, but the
we'll get into
again
that.
The jump from 1 to 2 makes 2 seem like so huge when the mm-hmm. jump from 2 to 3 is so mm-hmm. minuscule that it's like, oh well, 3 is all right.
No, I mean, we'll get into that. But I mean, Uncharted 2 was Among Thieves was the game that everyone started immediately paying attention to the PlayStation 3. Everyone went, holy fucking shit. Where, again, and I remember the trailer for it when I think they must have showed it at E3 2008, where it opens with Nathan Drake inside that train, and it's like he's sitting and he's been looks like he's been shot, and he's bleeding, and he gets like this like a plithy one-liner, and he looks out the window and he notices that he's on a fucking cliff, and then he tumbles out the back and he grabs onto that railing for dear life, and he's just in the train car's just swinging. It's an incredible moment. It sets up just the tone of that game. Again, it upped the ante from 1. It created so many more just breathtaking cinematic moments, which you don't even really see in many action films today. Yeah. It introduced, again, so many memorable characters. I mean, Chloe Frazier, who looking hot. He's got that butt. They showcase that butt like constantly, and they commented on it. It's like, man, hey, I appreciate it. I want to compliment her on it. But they also introduced Harry Flynn, the douchebag prick, constantly betrays you, like constantly. But then they reintroduced some incredible characters. Like, it really doubled down on the relationship between Elena Fisher and Nathan Drake, which we kind of learn there. You know, they kind of had this like, romantic fling in between one and two, didn't work out so well. And when they kind of meet each other, they're kind of a very rocky relationship. But again, it's like, as the game progresses, you know that they're kind of always meant for each other, that kind of thing. But then you also get a much more a memorable villain in Lazarevich, who is a total just James Bond megalomaniac. I have an infinite amount of resources and a mercenary army. I'm going to invade Nepal and take it over. Just so much fun. And again, those environments, like even like... The original opening where you're like in this Nepal like mountain range and the freight car is just swinging, just climbing up that. It's beautiful. And then in early portions of the game when you're trekking through this like jungle, which makes the jungle in Uncharted 1 look like oh my god, yeah. I can't believe I was praised in Uncharted 1. But then yeah, just these wonderful segments. The one of my kind of I think the most underrated moments in Uncharted 2 is when you're actually in that. City in Nepal, and where you're in a building and the building's slowly crumbling down and like all the furniture is like shifting and you have to jump from that building to the next one, the glass breaking. Incredible cinematic moment. And it's just, I can understand why it for many people it is the best Elder Charge series. Certainly was for me until the latter entry came out this year. But I mean, John, what was your opinion? What's your opinion on Uncharted 2, and what are some of your favorite moments from the game?
This is, like I said, this is why I see Naughty Dog as the best developer. Mm-hmm. This is also when they really took control of their characters. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just, that's what Naughty Dog is to me, is characters.
Yeah.
And they're really perfecting not just characters amongst them, like within themselves, but how these characters interact with each other, really building out relationships. Drake is as quippy as all hell.
But he's damaged. You're to see that.
Yeah, there's something to like dig into with him and Elena, and then Sully and his relationship just continues to expand. It's like very fatherly, but also brotherly, and it's protective, and they're in this together, and it's just, it's a movie.
Yeah,
in all of the best senses of the word, in which games try and be movies. This is, I think, what that should mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the commercials for. I think this was around that time. That Kevin guy.
The guy who was always constantly marketing.
Yeah, that was about the time when he was taking over their marketing control, and I love that one trailer. It's a bad commercial because it's very sexist, but where my girlfriend doesn't know it's not a movie.
Oh,
she's like, will you press play? Let's watch the thing. And it's like, it's very sexist commercial, but at the same time, it sort of gets that point across that, like,
sure,
watching Uncharted is fine. It's fun. Like, just to watch someone go through it, it's a movie. It's a Marvel. But yeah, this is one of the best games I think of all time.
Definitely. It was on my seven fave games when I made my Twitter thing. But then Uncharted 4, I was like, oh no, this replaces it. But no, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. And like, probably my favorite, other than the crumbling building, my other favorite sequence in the game is when you're on that train and you're constantly being attacked, and it constantly just ups the ante. Like when you jump from one train car to another and you see behind you, total Indiana Jones, just cinematic moment where the other train car's just like coming at you and it's just like falling apart. It's like, oh my god, it's such a beautiful just scene. Now, I do have a few complaints about it, Uncharted 2, specifically in regards to some plot elements. It is very, very similar to Uncharted 1. Where it's basically, Nathan Drake might have been betrayed by someone he knows very personally, even though it's kind of revealed later. In, like, the first Uncharted game, you think Sully might have betrayed you.
Yeah.
In this case, you actually are betrayed by someone. You keep going on, not believing that there is kind of a supernatural threat. There is a supernatural threat at the end. And it kind of redoes the initial encounter with Elena. Where it's like, you meet this girl, she doesn't really like you, then she starts to like you, and then you kind of form this bond over tragedy and hardship. You meet this girl again, she doesn't like you, you go throughout the game, all this hardship, and you start to reestablish that bond. It, to me, it felt like, in a similar way, where with A New Hope and like The Force Awakens, where it borrows a lot from each other.
It's almost
feels it's like a reset. It's like, okay, we know we may have made some mistakes with Uncharted 1, but
that
now
was a test
we're gonna
run.
Yeah. Even though I still think it's a good game.
Yeah, here's mm-hmm. the real thing.
Exactly.
Here's what we wanted to do, but it was so hard to develop for the PS3.
Yeah.
They're like, we finally figured it out. This is it.
Yeah, it feels like even if you hadn't played Uncharted 1, you can go into 2 and not feel lost or confused.
Yeah. Which is kind of how I think about these games in general, because they're kind of like movies in that sense where
it could contain story almost, to a certain extent.
We want to make it easy for someone who's never played one to jump in and like get a full effect, but we throw nods and like these relationships have more impact if you played the previous ones. Mm-hmm.
So. Now, not to be too negative, but do you have any complaints about 2 that you felt may have affected your enjoyment of the game, but you felt like that it could have been done better? Or
it's going to be the same complaint I have with 3.
Mm-hmm.
That gunplay's not great.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm. I thought that the certain climbing I do have another complaint. Not to interrupt your thought again, but I thought the museum segment was very, very weird and slow when you're robbing the museum with Flynn and where you have to knock out those guards and they constantly fucking spot you.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was kind of that really affected the base, especially after the beginning of that game when you're fucking from a freak.
Yeah, that's that's a great opening.
Yeah, it's a fantastic, probably arguably the best opening of any of the Uncharted games.
Yeah,
but yeah, kind of moving on to Uncharted 3, which I, in my opinion, is probably the weakest game in terms of pacing. What I felt that Uncharted 3 did best was it really seemed to focus on the relationship between Sully and Nathan. It really kind of showed that father-son relationship. And again, even though I thought how it was handled in terms of gameplay didn't work out very well, in terms of story, I thought it was really cool when, as soon as the opening cutscene of the game happens, you then, chapter 2, you go into this flashback where you play as a young Nathan Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in India, and you're on this you're trying to steal something basically
from a museum
from Helen Mirren, who is the villain of the game, who's not Helen Mirren. Catherine Marlowe Kate Marlowe, I think.
I just remember it's Helen Mirren.
It's Helen Mirren. It's the design, everything about it. But and then you meet a young Sully, and it's very much, even though to a certain extent it's kind of borrowing heavily from the Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, when Indy is trying to get this artifact from this very prototype Indiana Jones guy, even gives him the hat. And it kind of plays out in a similar way with Uncharted 3, with that particular flashback sequence. But again, it shows you the relationship between Sully and Drake and why that relationship is so important and why these characters care about each other so much and why it really is a father and son story, to a certain extent. Now, before I continue on with my complaints about the game, I mean, what about Uncharted 3 do you love, and did you like that kind of flashback sequence?
Yeah, because it's expounding upon a relationship. I sound like a broken record, but this is why I like Naughty Dog.
Yeah.
And this is what I come for in their games, is the relationships they build between, two people, or two things, in the case of Jack and Dexter. An otzel and a human. But yeah, this kind of dynamic, I'm cool with it expounding upon it. For the sake of the gameplay, that you kind of just slow down at those kind of bits.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said earlier, I think it gets a worse rap than it should, because to me, it's just as good as Uncharted 2.
I disagree.
Basically the same sort of structure, which I guess feels more repetitive this time around, because it's like, we did this maybe 2 years prior, 3 years prior, I forgot what the gap is. But for me,
it was 2009, because I remember the turnaround for Uncharted 1 came out in 2007, Uncharted 2 was 2009, and then Uncharted 3 was 2011, so it was pretty quick.
Okay, yeah, and for me, even quicker, because
I played them back to back.
Like, going from 1 to 2, it's like, oh my gosh, this is big.
Sure.
Going straight to 2 to 3, it's kind of like, this is basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Which is great. Mm-hmm. It's all 10 out of 10s. Mm-hmm. Awesome. But it's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess, for me, I mean, the game also reintroduces some new characters. Of course, we get Chloe Frazier again, who's barely in the game, which I was kind of disappointed about, because I loved her so much in 2. I thought she was so much fun and a great foil for Drake and Elena, you know, that kind of cool, like, love triangle.
Yeah, she plays a backseat.
She's even her butt is smaller in this, which I was kind of disappointed. They don't show it off as much, which I was kind of sad about. And they introduced some bald-headed British guy who I can't remember the name of his name at all, but I don't remember. He's Elena's boyfriend, or not Elena's boyfriend, but Chloe's boyfriend, who goes crazy for whatever reason, because they introduced possibly the worst villain in the Uncharted franchise in Talbot, who apparently has superpowers, who can disappear and reappear at any time. You shoot him in cutscenes, he's like, I'm alive, I'm Talbot, I'm slightly cross-eyed for some reason in the cutscenes because they didn't render properly. And like that, I was like, I just thought I'm such an obnoxious character. But really, the problems that I have with Uncharted 3 are the pacing, where there are points in the game where I felt like, why am I playing this section? Why can't this be a cutscene? Particularly after one of probably the most cinematic moments in the game, when you're falling out of the cargo airplane. Mm-hmm. And you're tumbling down, you end up in the desert, and the entire section you have
to... kind of just walk.
You just walk, you hallucinate, fucking Talbot, shut up, Talbot, stop talking to me. And it's just a really weird, awkward point in the game where it's like, why am I doing this? Why can't this just be a cool cutscene? And not...
To me, I think that kind
of
stuff...
It goes on for 20 minutes.
Oh, is it really that long?
Yeah, it's long.
Oh, okay. To me, stuff like that usually builds immersion, mm-hmm. in a sense. I don't remember it.
But I always felt
long.
Immersed when I was, you know, on a boat that was capsizing in on itself, which, again, is another incredible moment. That,
yeah.
Escaping that ship, because there's a point in the game when you think Sully's been kidnapped, and he's like, oh, my God. And he goes, even though it has, like, almost nothing to do with the main plot at all, it's like a side story, mm-hmm. that entire, it goes like the Poseidon Adventure, where you have to escape this sinking ship. It just has those moments where it feels like, even though it has those great cinematic moments from 2, but it slows down to a point where, not for even character reasons or not even for plot reasons, it just slows down to like, oh, we don't really know what to put here, at least for me. But
this is kind of like a tangent to that.
Yeah.
Is this the one where it has the beautiful fire effect, or is that 2?
I think that is the... I mean, there is a...
Where the house is burning down. And you're
yes, that, yeah.
Is it 3?
It is 3, the chateau, which is a great level. Except, you know, the part where you basically just fucking walked around solving puzzles the entire goddamn time.
I like
which,
puzzles.
Again, some of the worst puzzles in Uncharted 3 that, again, they kill it. The pacing, they kill it.
I think it's probably one of those victims of... It just came out too soon.
Yeah.
It was not enough time, because mm-hmm. you will get into 4... which I haven't played, but we'll get into 4, where I think they were given enough time to really kind of mm-hmm. expound upon it.
I think 5 years.
Yeah, and even though they had a game in between that we'll also talk about.
I mean, you can talk about that one.
What? Anyway, but with 3...
I thought you meant Golden Abyss. I'm sorry.
No, no, no. Yeah. But with 3, what you're talking about kind of feels like it's getting the same sort of problems that Tomb Raider runs into, mm-hmm. I think, as it kept going, which I think is kind of funny, because Uncharted is a Tomb Raider ripoff, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. It stars an adventurer who steals stuff. He steals ancient artifacts.
Uncharted is a Tomb Raider ripoff, which is an Indiana Jones ripoff, which is probably a ripoff of something.
Yeah. Those classic 30s serials.
Yeah.
From, you know, which
everyone did it first. Mm-hmm. Simpsons always did it first.
Simpsons
did it.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, to me it's still...
It still worked for you even
it,
though...
It all still worked problems. For me, but mm-hmm. I can see, it's been a while since I played it, and I played it so closely to 2 that they kind of mushed together for me as one just great cinematic adventure. Because, like I said, I can't really quite remember which set pieces are from which game, because to me
they
meld together, which some might see as a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I see as 2 10 out of 10s. Mm-hmm. Like, 2 great experiences that I would always, I recommend to anybody.
Uncharted 2 to me is a 10, and maybe that's because I have my nostalgia filter on a little bit. Uncharted 3, I think, is like an 8.5. You know, it does some amazing things. The relationship between Sully and Drake is fantastic. But again, it's those pacing issues. And I think a lot of the stuff was even... Maybe this isn't fair to Naughty Dog. I kind of blame Sony for this. A lot of the big kind of cinematic moments are spoiled in the game. Like the part where you're falling out of the airplane. Mm-hmm. That was heavily advertised in, Subway commercials. Like, you know, win a copy of it's, you know, on, Uncharted it's on 3 the cup. And buy a sub. It's like,
on the cup.
Yeah, it's just like, it does be disappointing. But despite my complaints about 3, I did appreciate what it was doing. Especially, and even like the chateau, which you brought up, and that whole burning, the whole thing's like coming down. It's just beautiful, and the fire effects are just wonderful. And I thought it has like a really kind of a nice ending, particularly between Drake, Sully, and Elena, which the story could have ended there for a lot of, it's a nice cap.
It's a nice little hurrah for, it could have been for the Uncharted series, but also for the PlayStation 3. Until they were like, no, let's squeeze one more big thing out of here.
Yeah, so do you want to talk about The Last of Us, or do you want to talk about Uncharted 4?
I think we should go in the order of what they did, because I think Last of Us, because also I haven't played Uncharted 4, so that'll be more you, but what did you think of Last of Us? I think Last of Us is...
I think it's the best PS3 game. I think it's Naughty Dog's... I think it's the best PS3
game. It's the one thing I don't want to see them franchise.
So you don't want a sequel to that story?
No. Like, other than the DLC, which adds more character to Ellie.
Which is great.
You know, Ellen Page, basically.
It's Ellie.
Yeah, it's not Ellen Page. But
originally, it looked a lot like Ronnie.
This got a lot of emotion out of me. It is basically what The Walking Dead set up with great gameplay. The Walking Dead Telltale series.
The video game, which had come out a year before, actually.
Yeah. It's that same sort of burly man, young little girl.
Father-daughter story.
Adoptive father-daughter story. Mm-hmm. Again, it opens great. I love the opening, and I think it made me tear up.
Probably one of the most just emotional and heart-wrenching openings to the video game I've ever played. I mean, for people don't know, it's The Last of Us is kind of really... it's an apocalypse type game where it takes place during an apocalypse where this infection has overtaken the world, and it's like almost this fungus type infection that affects humans. You slowly start to go insane. You become this almost these horribly disgusting mushroom creatures and or fungus creatures. And even though what's so terrifying about the particular disease is that even though slowly you're becoming this thing, you're always aware of it and you're not really insane. Like, it just affects your mind and your motor functions and where you're doing this. And basically, it drives you to, like, a primal instinct, even though you yourself are completely aware of what's happening, which is fucking horrifying. But, to reverse where the opening of The Last of Us, you're introduced to this character named Joel, voiced by and mocap by Troy Baker, who would go on to be, much like Nolan North, voice every fucking character.
And then it all comes full circle on Uncharted 4.
Yes, it does. But it opens up with Joel and his daughter, who actually live in Austin, Texas, which is fucking crazy. Oh, that's cool. The beginning of the game takes place in Austin, or at least right outside of Austin, and where it's the beginning of the apocalypse, where the world is just fucking falling apart, and where you're kind of trying to escape with your daughter and your brother, and where in the beginning, at the end of that section, you play as the daughter, and you eventually take over as Joel. But it ends where you're trying to escape this kind of like a border checkpoint where you encounter this soldier, and he shoots at Joel, killing his daughter, and then him breaking down crying. And it's just like, holy shit, what an opening to the game. did you expect that when you first played The Last of Us? Something that, I mean, we kind of knew it would be like a sad game, you know?
It's really Naughty Dog going like, we're going to do whatever we want to do.
Yeah.
And I think it also makes the rest of the game more terrifying because it's Naughty Dog saying, we'll kill a little girl. So you protect the one we're giving you.
Makes you care all the more.
It makes you care more about Ellie because you honestly believe that something bad could happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of similar feelings. It's hard for me not to tie it in The Walking Dead together because I also did play them fairly close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing that I think the first season of The Walking Dead does well, too. It, like, because so many people are dying off, you honestly believe something could happen to Clementine if I mess up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what The Last of Us What The Last of Us does so good is just, again, it's presenting these really unique characters and making you care about them.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with Joel and Emmy, we're introduced to Ellie, who to me is probably one of the best video game characters, I think, in recent memory. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't really, you know, I remember at the time, like, Last of Us came out during the same time as Bioshock Infinite, and people were saying, oh, Elizabeth and Ellie are two of the greatest people in the game, and I fucking hate Elizabeth. And with Ellie, she was a gameplay mechanic. That's what she functioned as. With Ellie, she was just, she felt like a living, breathing character. And where even when, it's like when you're walking, the game takes place where you learn that Ellie might potentially be the cure for this infection, where she was bitten by one of these fungus zombies, did not change at all. And they're thinking, okay, it's something to do with her body chemistry, and we have to get you to a key point because there's this organization called the Fireflies who are trying to, basically they're this kind of rebel group who are kind of like fighting against, like, there's all these kind of like despots everywhere all around the country, and the particular one, I think it takes place initially in Boston. They're trying to basically establish a new kind of order for the world. And where they want, they kind of task Joel and this other person who's with him, Tess, to have Ellie take her from, I think, Boston to, I think, somewhere in Utah or somewhere, definitely, basically the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. And for Ellie, like, just how she interacts with the environment and how she interacts with you, where even when you're just walking in this, like, dilapidated, like, building or this city, which, again, the environments in The Last of Us are beautiful. They're beautiful, but they're also just, like, again, it establishes this tragedy of this world where it's like the vegetation is starting to take over, and like even though it's like everything's falling apart, and like you see Ellie, like, I think looking at I think it was like at a movie poster or no, it was like at a magazine cover, and she comments, it's like, why are all these girls so skinny on these covers? And he's thinking, all back then people found that attractive, they don't eat because people find that attractive. She's like, why would anyone want to do that? You know, because we live in a world where if she was born into a world which is over, the world is fucked up. It's humanity is lost. And even though she's this one hope, and she's like, why would you eat food? Because you're going to fucking starve. It's just so interesting how they introduce the little kind of things. And even like when she carries around this joke book, and she's constantly reading these terrible jokes to you along the way. It's just like, again, it makes you care for that character so much. And in turn, Joel, who you play as for most of the game. But the one thing, before we get into more of the characters in the game, which I think there are some incredible characters that you care for and just learn to hate, is that with this game, I think this is Naughty Dog's best game in terms of gameplay, where I loved how they introduced, like, it's very much a stealth-based game, particularly when you try to avoid the fungus zombies, which I think are called clickers, actually, if I can remember, and how you have to use sound to escape them, where most of the time you just don't want to encounter them at all or try to avoid them, because ammo is particularly scarce in this game, and weapons, like, you can upgrade your weapons as you go along, but ammo is very limited, your resources are very limited, and that I liked really much. But this is probably one of the few games where I didn't like to kill human enemies, because the death animations and the way in which you killed some of these people are so brutal. Like, when you choke a person in this game, you see his eyes bulge out of his head. And not like a comical way, but like he's gasping and he's like struggling just to get out of that. Or when you shove a person's face into like a broken window pane and see the glass go into their neck and they're sputtering with blood, they're choking on their own blood. It's like, this game makes me uncomfortable about violence, which, you know, I've played Doom, I've played Gears of War, which are, it's ridiculous and over the top, and there's gore and blood, but for this, whatever reason, it felt so realistic that it made me like, ooh.
Yeah.
But not in a bad way. Just in like, I feel bad about what I'm doing, even though I'm enjoying the game.
It's because the game has a human element.
Yeah.
Like, all in it. Naughty Dog just doing what they do best, really perfecting their craft and kind of just showing off at this point.
Yeah.
Just like,
oh yeah.
They're just like, oh, we could make another entry in that franchise, but let's try something fun. And I think the stealth based gameplay, and the somewhat like off kilter shooting, which is a little better here, but it works a lot more.
It's not as floaty as Uncharted.
And it also works a lot more because it's not perfect, but it works more here because you don't want to have to shoot.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in a firefight. And I think those clickers that you mentioned are terrifying.
They are.
Just like hearing that, like, it's that. Just, ugh. And it just works so well. It has you entranced in what they've built, this world that they've built. And I wanted to comment on the Ellie thing too as well. I know there's a certain scene in the game where I can't remember the character's name, but it's a guy sort of doesn't want her touching his stuff.
Yeah, you encounter another kind of fellow survivor who's lived out in the wasteland by himself for a significant amount of time. But I know exactly what
you're
talking
about. And he's like bugging him, like, don't touch my toys, don't touch my magazines or whatever. And just like nice little character beat that is easy to miss is if you like look back at her, she like takes something of his and puts it in her backpack because she's like, well, I want it. It's neat. Because I love the fact that she was born outside of the normal world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a wonderful writing decision from the get-go because, like you mentioned earlier, you get to experience this world. Oh, you get to experience our world from the eyes of someone who, you know, doesn't understand the things that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's just it's a beautiful game with beautiful gameplay. Absolutely. And one of those few times where I thought this DLC is worth it.
The DLC, I want to talk about the DLC and just a few things I want to talk about in the base game first where, like, it's funny how you mentioned that moment with Ellie when she encounters that character, who, as you learn throughout the progression when you meet him, is actually gay, and he's actually been searching for his lover for a certain amount of time, and you find that person later on in a very, again, another tragic moment in the game, and it's even more heart-wrenching if you discover the letter that he left behind. But it establishes that Ellie is also gay, or at least a bisexual character, and where it's a little, again, it's Naughty Dog, the expert storytellers, where when that character in the game says, don't touch my stuff, and she's looking at a pornographic magazine, and it's, you know, it's a male pornographic magazine, and she's like, I'm not really interested in that. It's like, and it's that little thing where you again, it could be just a throwaway funny line, but it plays into the DLC, which was left behind, mm-hmm. where it's a prequel to The Last of Us story, where it's Ellie.
A prequel and also an inter.
Yeah, it takes place. It's a prequel where it kind of shows the events before that, but also during a certain part of the game where you take over and you play as Ellie to a certain extent, particularly during the winter segment of the game. And it's where Riley is the character. And Riley, who has joined the Fireflies, the organization we mentioned before, and kind of she says she's going to be leaving to join their organization. And it's basically about Ellie and Riley, kind of their last day together. And you go to this abandoned mall. And it's where, for like almost like an hour and a half, where you're just interacting with the environment, interacting with this character you're introduced to, and you get to know them and through their various interactions with each other. And in certain points of the DLC, you can almost get romantically involved with Riley. And it actually plays out in the end where that, to me, a really beautiful moment where Ellie kisses Riley. And it's just kind of this, like, these two young persons in this horribly tragic world are kind of finding this nice, quiet moment together. And, of course, it ends in tragedy, as most of The Last of Us does. But, I mean, you played The Left Behind.
Yeah. Actually, when you mentioned the fact that, like, at the beginning of this thing where you mentioned that Ellie gets bit and she finds out that
this is the point.
It just like immediately flashback to how Left Behind ends and how it's just like, that sucks,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah, because in the DLC, like, yeah, it ends with Ellie and Riley getting bit, and it kind of plays into that where even the base game when Riley, or when Ellie talks to Joel about, when I was bit, it was just me and my friend, and I think we both said, let's just go insane together.
Yeah.
And where Riley did, but she didn't.
And I kind of love...
sets up that tragedy.
I love the way it ends. It's just like, well, let's just
write it out.
And it just, like, black, you know, hits black
after
that. Happens. Because you know what happens, and it just lets you sit there. It doesn't have to show you
mm-hmm.
what happens to Riley.
It doesn't show you that scene when
Yeah,
when
it lets it work into your brain, and, like, you just start to feel more for Ellie. You figure out why she's so, like, tough as you're traveling through the game, and also why she's so capable.
Mm-hmm.
Except
when it comes to swimming.
Yeah.
That's the one mistake.
But also, you know, I think the game won a lot of awards, the DLC alone, just because of that. And the way, I don't know, it shows the progression of the world as well. It's like we're starting to let, you know, LGBTQ
come
into games.
Absolutely.
And like, and I think it's a brilliant moment too, because in that universe, when you don't really have much of anything, I think the people that you're around, you know, that's what you hold on to. And so, like, that relationship, even though it's a short DLC, that relationship...
It's like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful relationship, and it makes you appreciate more your time with Ellie and her growth as a character through mm-hmm. The Last of Us. Which also the ending of Last of Us infuriated me in a way that like I just like didn't know if I liked it, and I still not quite sure I liked it, but it like made me hate a character that I loved throughout the whole game, and it's just only Naughty Dog is really like only a select few developers can do that.
Before we talk about the ending, because I definitely want to talk about the ending, I want to talk about one more particular story segment in that game, and it's during the winter segment when Joel, and I think in one portion of the game, he's been critically injured, and he's on, like, death's door, that kind of thing.
This is when Left Behind takes place, correct?
It takes place, yeah, in this story, but in the base game, between when Joel is injured and you're playing as Ellie, you encounter another survivor called David. And he's kind of the leader of his own community. And he's voiced by Nolan North in a surprising vocal performance in mocap, which I never expected. Mm-hmm. Because it is so unlike Nolan North. And when you meet David, you're kind of unsure about him. But he helps you in this one particular segment. Again, the gameplay... through gameplay, they establish trust of this character. And it kind of establishes one of the most creepiest moments in the game when you're... I mean, you learn that David and his community are basically been eating people. And when he captures Ellie and you think that it's for the purpose of using her as food, there's this particular quiet moment between the two characters when Ellie's locked up in her cell and David's there, and you kind of realize it's like, oh, he wants to rape Ellie, basically. And it establishes a point in the game which I never thought Naughty Dog would touch on, mm-hmm. particularly because it's such a incredibly sensitive and just like a subject that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And the fact that they present it in such a quiet way was just to me so compelling. It's like I remember when David reaches through the bars and when Ellie takes his hand and then she fucking breaks his fucking thumb. It was such a triumphant moment. And then later on in the DLC, where really it's the only except for the Claudriceps or the Tickers, like certain boss battle segments, it's the only boss battle where you're actually fighting a human character with Ellie, and where you're in that abandoned diner and it's on fire, mm-hmm. and David is looking for you, and he's just basically he's again doing what he wants to do. And then there's that moment when you finally take him down and Ellie has him on the floor and she's just bashing his head open with his own machete, and it's just this incredibly just it's this visceral moment where I had all these different types of emotions. And then when Joel finally finds her and he's holding her, and you don't really know if he understands what has happened, but he knows
something's different.
And as you take over as Joel again, and yeah, it's that you were as Joel, and you're kind of going through the opening segment after that scene when you kill David, you know something is very different with Ellie. And it leads to, again, one of the most beautiful moments in the game when you come upon a herd of giraffes in this abandoned city, because again the zoos are not run by people anymore, yeah. obviously, and all these escaped animals. And again, it's this very quiet moment where it's like, again, for The Last of Us, it works so well. Even like the gameplay is fantastic and these wonderful cinematic moments, but it's the quiet moments to me that really stick out. But I don't know if you particularly like anything with the winter segment. Or
what I wanted to comment on was this game takes place over a good portion of a year.
Yes, it does.
So you get to watch the world go through its cycle.
Mm-hmm,
and I love the fact that it all feels similar but different in a way. Like, the winter, those segments feel more distressing
mm-hmm.
because it's like such a harsh environment. It's much darker, much colder. And then it makes the spring, like those moments with the giraffes, feel so much more grand and more impactful. And it's, I love the way Naughty Dog made that decision mm-hmm. to take you through seasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really
winter's the lowest point.
Yeah. Yeah. Winter's the lowest point. And that's, but it makes spring seem much more vast and mm-hmm. beautiful.
Rebirth.
And, yeah.
Thing.
So
becomes something new. Yeah. But the ending, if you want to get into that, if you want to just run through kind of what happens at the ending or why you felt frustrated or why you kind of your opinion changed on a certain character.
Yeah, so spoilers ahead for a game that's
been out
for like 3 years.
We're spoiling. I mean, if you're still listening at this point, we've been spoiling these games. Yeah. Sorry. It's been out for 5 years.
But
almost 5 years.
You spend so much time with Ellie protecting her. You finally make it to Salt Lake City.
Yeah. So I was right. You did.
Yeah. And find the Fireflies, and you give Ellie away, and she's, ready to do whatever she has to do to,
For the cure.
Joel finds out that they are going to perform surgery on her, and they need to take out a piece of the infected part of her brain to figure out what's going on. and this is going to kill her.
Yep.
And Joel decides, no, like, that is not what I want. I love this little girl. She is like my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to kill her. So he goes in, he takes out the fireflies and rescues Ellie in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she confronts him on it, he lies to her. And that was the part that bothered me. And the game just sort of ends because she asks him at the very end. She's like, is that really what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's it.
And then she says, okay. Yeah. Because I think she knows that he's lying to her about what really, really happened. I mean, continue on.
I don't know. Like, I'm not sure she knew. Mm-hmm. It's been a little while since I played it. But mm-hmm. to me, it also just felt like Ellie had made very clear what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was fine with dying because she had lost her best friend to this thing. And she was like, I don't want that to happen to anyone else. And mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, it just made me hate Joel for, one, still treating Ellie like a child.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was very adult at that point in time. She'd gone through so much that she was like, this is the decision I want to make. And he sort of went back on that. And you're killing for selfish reasons also at that point, which kind of, I don't know, leaves me iffy on Joel and what you're doing. But none of that is to say, I don't like the story for that reason.
Yeah.
I think what Naughty Dog makes you do and, like, has you feeling about this character is very, like, on point with what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I felt so conflicted and weird about what they were doing shows how well written everything mm-hmm. was and how enveloped they had me at that point.
See, I understand why you felt that way, and even like when a lot of people came out and weren't big fans of the ending. For me, I love the fact that I ended up in a certain way being the villain of the game. That Joel ended up being the villain of the game, where he was. It's established even early on, when you're talking of certain characters, that Joel is a very selfish character, and that because of the loss of his daughter, he's apparently done horrible things throughout his life. There's even this one again, another really quiet moment which I love, where Ellie, where Joel was constantly looking at his watch over and over, which as you learn is a gift that was given to him by his daughter on the night of the infection, or the infection that in Austin. And throughout the game, he's constantly looking at it. And you're thinking, like, oh, was he, you know, and you think, oh, he's checking the time or something. And then you learn when Ellie, when kind of in the beginning of the relationship, when she looks at his watch, he's like, your watch is broken, like in a very kind of sarcastic way. And you learn that he just keeps thinking of his daughter. That's all. That's why he has that thing. Mm-hmm. He won't let it go.
Yeah.
And that's the point. To me, it's like where I went, oh, because he loved his daughter so much, that's why he keeps his watch, because the last thing he ever gave him. With Ellie, he found, in Ellie, he found his daughter again, the thing he lost.
Which
and
is,
he will never, like his watch, he will never give that up. He will kill innocent people to keep her alive. And there's this one particular, when you were playing the end of the game, and when you find Ellie in the operating room, did you kill the doctors?
I don't recall, but I don't know. I want to say I didn't, but also it feels like it could have been one of those instances where I was so, like, as the character, it was like, well, that's what he needs to do to protect the girl, and I kind of feel like I probably
See,
did.
I kind of fell into the role of, it's weird, it's like, because the doctors don't attack you
yeah.
in that segment. They actually back away because they're terrified of you. And I became Joel, but it's like, what would Joel... I asked myself, like, during the scene, what would Joel do in the scene? And I murdered every single one of those doctors. And, like, the last person, who I think was the woman, who I think there were two males and one woman, and the woman was screaming, and she was terrified, and she was trying to protect herself, and I still killed her, because they were going to kill that little girl who I grew to care about in that game. And I said, no, everyone's going to suffer, and you're going to suffer. Fuck you. She's mine. And I realized at that moment, I'm the villain. And I don't think there's been a video game that has made me feel that way where I was totally fine. It's not like, you know, in a Star Wars Knights of the Republic where I go dark side and I'm fucking killing everybody and taking all their money and making them do horrible things. But this, it's like, you progress. It's like, I just made that choice because, like, no, I think this is what I would do in this scenario.
Yeah.
I want to make these people suffer because they tried to take something away from me that I cared about. And no video game has made me feel that way. And then with the ending, when, to me, I think Ellie does know that Joel is lying to her, And maybe at that point she's like, it's like, that's why I want a sequel. I want to see what happens next. What would their relationship be 10 years later? You know, would they still be that father-daughter relationship, or would they fucking hate each other at that point? I want to see just that. I think it'd be so cool. Like, what if that moment was kind of the catalyst that point in which they went on these two different paths, and maybe Joel has become this horrible person. Ellie has to be the one to put him down. I think that'd be so unique. And for me, that's why I want a sequel. And that's why I particularly love the ending, because it's so ambiguous, even though it kind of establishes that the relationship is based on a lie now.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that gives them plenty of room to do something interesting in the sequel.
But you like that ambiguity. But you like the ambiguity. You don't feel like the need, like that's necessary.
Yeah, I just feel like, I don't know, it just ends in such a way where I remember.
Yeah.
You know, what happens. Mm-hmm. I remember the fact that he lied and that what it made me feel, and it's just, I don't know, I think I'm just worried that a sequel could taint that.
Sure.
And do something different. So.
What about if they did, like, another story that takes place in that world that has nothing to do with Joel or Ellie? Would you be open for something like that? Or do you feel like you don't really want to see another story?
I think I'd rather in that case, I'd rather have Naughty Dog do something new.
A new, totally new franchise. Yeah. Totally new. I completely understand. Maybe, you know, I think eventually... I think even Nolan North like said it like a year ago. Oh yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah, I know. It is coming. It's coming. It is coming.
So we'll see. I'm interested to see what it'll be. But yeah, kind of moving on to the most recent game that Naughty Dog's worked on, Uncharted 4 Among Thieves, which, you know, John has not played, but I think eventually what I want to do is, even though I reviewed it for the site, which you can read, that we should do kind of an audio review for Uncharted 4. Kind of like an end of the year wrap up, maybe the games that we miss and just to talk about them. Mm-hmm. But just to go over briefly, like, Uncharted 4 takes place several years after the events of Uncharted 3, where Nathan Drake is retired from treasure hunting. He's in a relationship. He's married to Elena. They have this really kind of domestic lifestyle. And it's just this kind of, like, it's interesting to see, like, kind of an old, but that's, to a certain extent, a beaten down Nathan Drake. Especially, you know, when he was doing quippy one-liners or anything like that. But what the game kind of establishes, like, in the initial few chapters is that apparently Nathan Drake had a brother named Sam, voiced and mocapped by Troy Baker. Who would have thought? But yeah, the entire game is kind of about Sam Drake coming to Nathan to tell him, you know, basically you learn throughout the entire game that Nathan and Sam, when they were kids, oh, by the way, Nathan Drake, Drake's not his real name. Spoiler. Cool. That's established in Uncharted 3. Okay. So I think that was spoiled. This was missed. But that their entire lives, like back when they were like teenagers, they were completely obsessed with finding this pirate treasure. I think it was Avery's treasure, which apparently was Captain, I think Henry Avery, I think real person, performed this incredible heist, the largest heist in human history, and where he had all this gold. He established this humongous pirate colony where all these other pirates came to, like, basically trying to establish their own utopia, and I think off the coast of Madagascar. And basically it's Sam asking Nate to come out of retirement, help me do this. I might be in trouble with some dangerous cartel people, you know, who want to cut off my balls. And so you kind of go on this last adventure.
Cartels really love balls.
Yeah, yes, they're all about that. They love castrating. But yeah, I mean, the entire game is just kind of about Nathan Drake kind of, again, rekindling his relationship with his brother, but also through most of the game, it's saying goodbye to all these characters. It's so, in much the same way that Mass Effect 3 was a journey just to say goodbye to all these characters that you've come to love, this is what Uncharted 4 is about, and where it's about saying goodbye to Sully, who is still, even though he is much, much older, he's still fucking pulling scams and everything like that. And then it's really doubling down on the incredible relationship building between Nathan and Elena, where in my favorite segment of the game, I think it's a chapter 4, and where you're just in your suburban home with Elena, and you're fucking in your attic, which is all filled with all your little knickknacks from your past adventure. You got the little the gold coin from the island in Uncharted 1. You have the resin it's the resin from Uncharted 2, and all these other little things, and like the kind of the compass or whatever the hell that device was.
Do you really like that
Golden
Abyss shout-out?
Yeah. There actually is a Golden Abyss shout-out in Uncharted 4. There is. Yeah, they actually mentioned one of the characters from that game. It's in that entire kind of sequence is just paying homage to the entire franchise. Mm-hmm. It's like, look at all this fun stuff that we have for you here. But my favorite part in that game is when you go down the stairs and you get to even go through kind of all your other little knickknacks and memorabilia, where you get to go in your bedroom and you get to look at your wedding photos with Elena, and you get to reminisce about your vacations when you went to Thailand. It's like these little small things. And when you finally go downstairs and she's there, she's working on an article, and you kind of like, oh, could you grab some drinks? And I made dinner on the table, and you bring it over to her and you just have a fucking conversation with her. And it's like, there's never been a moment like that in an Uncharted game where it's like this domestic lifestyle. It feels so normal and natural. And probably what I'm saying doesn't sound so exciting, but the fact that this game is about saying goodbye to these characters that we all really care about, It works so well. That even when you get to those amazing segments in the game, when you're, you know, trailing behind a truck or you're barely holding on the rope and the mud's kicking up and bad guys are shooting at you, or you're on this pirate colony of all these incredibly dangerous traps and booby traps and mummies are exploding all around you, that moment, that quiet moment when you're just at home with your wife speaking with her and, you know, talking about the how was your day, honey, it stands out right next to all those other hugely epic moments. But again, what I also appreciate about, and one, it's beautiful. I think it has the best gameplay of the series, even though it kind of continues like where it's not as good as something like The Last of Us, but it is the best gunplay in that series, and it has the best climbing mechanic. Introduces a grappling hook, which you can use, which again is so much fun. I love that. But then what the franchise also does, which really well, is actually the new villains. Introduces the character of Rafe, who you learn you actually worked with in the past when you're looking for Avery's treasure with Sam. And what I love about Rafe is that he's not a megalomaniac. He's not obsessed with becoming more wealthy. He's established as being one of the wealthiest characters in the world or something, or one of the wealthiest people in the world, like his family. His whole thing is that he's obsessed with legacy and the fact that he is so insanely jealous of Nathan Drake. And he's like, you had to fight for everything your entire life, and I've never had to. And it's like, I have all this infinite wealth. He wants to be Nathan Drake, and he's anything but that. And where they even introduced this other character, what's her name? Nadine, voiced by the great Laura Bailey, who's been a ton of Telltale games. She's such a great voice actress, where he constantly has to rely on her because he's, even though he's competent in so many other ways, he's so incompetent. Mm-hmm. And where she has, he had to buy her mercenary army, you know, to fight against Drake, who constantly subverts his every move. But even like the particular, I don't want to spoil too much of the games. I want John to play it. But that moment when he kind of confronts Nathan Drake in the end, and he's just so fucking bitter, and just he's going over like, oh, the great Nathan Drake, who discovered the El Dorado, the ancient, chased a maniac to the steps of Shambhala, who discovered the ancient pillar of Aram. It's like you just hear him going over this, and he's like, this is such a great fucking character. And the ending of the game, probably one of the most, in much the same way that Last of Us, which was a very quiet moment, and again, saying ambiguous, Uncharted 4's ending is a definitive end to these characters and their journey. Where, I mean, I guess they could, if they wanted to, go and tell a side story in the past, but I don't know how you possibly can with Uncharted 4's ending, where it's just, it's a perfect cap, and you feel just so happy for everyone involved, and it's just, again, it's evidence of the fact that Naughty Dog understands these characters so well,
yeah,
and knows what fans want. And to a certain extent, you can say it was kind of fan servicey, but man, I fucking wanted that. I wanted an ending that made me feel good.
Yeah.
So, but that's why, John, I think you should definitely check out Uncharted 4 when you have the opportunity.
No, I'll probably pick up that PS4 Slim next week. I get a sweet big boy paycheck.
Oh, big boy paycheck.
So, I'll probably have it completed, but, by next month.
Yeah.
Least.
Yeah,
but just hearing us talk, we spent so much on the like last two games, last like couple games
I
alone.
Think because they were
they're one of, I keep saying one of, but honestly to me I think they are the best developer.
No, I would agree. I agree though.
They're everything that I want from video games, because I think the best thing about video games is fun gameplay first off, but fun stories, while still being able to be serious. And I think Naughty Dog has that perfect blend of fun with Uncharted, or drama with Last of Us, or just like goofball cartoons with Jack and Daxter and Crash Bandicoot, despite what you say. And I don't know. I think it's great to have a developer like them. And I'm glad they're also like a Sony exclusive thing, because I think it's just kind of cool that, you know, just a real strong first party developer.
No, I mean, it put PlayStation on the map for a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, I think at the PS3, it was even a joke I used to say back then when I wasn't the biggest fan of the console. I said, it's my Naughty Dog machine, which I play all the Naughty Dog games on. But no, it's like these, it just makes me excited for what Naughty Dog is going to do next. And with the Uncharted franchise over, you know, and, you know, with Last of Us 2 coming, I want to see them do something new.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
And I think everyone should be excited for it, because their track record has proven it's going to be great.
No, absolutely. And then for anyone who has not played these games, and even for the Crash Bandicoot game, which they're doing remasters for, they're coming out.
2017. We're going to have that Crash Bandicoot. We're going to go full deep dive Crash Bandicoot when that remaster comes out. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. I will do it. I'll do it for that. I'll do it. I'll play him. I got my PS4. I'll play him. I'll give that stupid Bandicoot, whatever the hell he is, another chance. I'll give that. But, yeah, for anyone who hasn't played any of Naughty Dog's games, definitely check them out.